Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour as we look at some of the major stories in business and politics at home here in Ireland and around the world. Coming up on today's show, in the US, there's a split-screen election underway with Donald Trump in the dock in a criminal case, and President Biden was doing his best to tell everyone all about it. Lauren Fedor of the Financial Times will bring us the latest from the US election campaign. And closer to home, immigration was a big news story as borders once again became an issue. So new checks on exports from Ireland to the UK on agri and food products largely went unnoticed. But later in the show, we'll find out how they went down with business and what they might mean for us as consumers. And finally today, we're going to delve into the ever-evolving landscape of AI in business and politics. And we'll be looking at the efforts of countries who are trying to vie for control and regulation of this very transformative sector. You can email me, as always, at takingstock@newstalk.com. I'm also open on Twitter at StockNT. So first up today, we're going to look at the area of AI, because the rapid advance of artificial intelligence has literally captivated the world with the possibility of helping us all in all different ways in our lives. But to what extent will AI and the need for the resources that support AI become part of its development? Well, I'm joined now by Mark Kelly, who is the Chief Commercial Officer at Aldus. He's also founder of AI Ireland and author of AI Unleashed. Mark, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
How are you, Mandy? How are you?
Now, Mark, it's so pervasive in all of our discussions now, AI coming into our lives in lots of different ways. But just how transformative has AI been in recent years in particular, and how it's integrated into our lives in ways that we maybe don't even at first recognise?
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that AI has been all around us since 1956. There was a gentleman called John McCarthy who coined the term artificial intelligence. His dad actually came from Cremone in County Kerry. So there's been some spurts and kind of winters along the way, but it's fair to say when ChatGPT came to town in November 2022, the world stood up. And within 8 weeks, over 100 million users of the technology happened. And really what they did was they put an interface to a technology that was already there. And it's just exploded. Like, there's now 67,500 AI companies, $191 million is spent training some models. And I'll give you one more stat, $25.2 billion was invested in generative AI in 2023. So it is driven by the opportunity to do more with less. And today we were able to classify objects, you know, at a near human level. It's going to exceed human performance on certain benchmarks. And some of the state-of-the-art GPT-4, Gemini, and Claude are impressively multimodal. So they can literally generate text in dozens of languages, process audio, and they could actually even explain a meme to you or take a picture and tell you what way you should go, what direction. So it's incredible to see what's happened in the space of 12 months.
And why do you think that the advance of ChatGPT was such a game changer last November?
Because what they did was make a technology available for anybody just to access through a free version. And people were able to use it for a variety of different case studies. So it could be write me a poem. It could be create me some sales and marketing copy. It could be like, I've got this issue with my personal life, what advice would you share? Pretend you're, take on the persona of a sports coach, give me some fitness advice that I should follow. There were so many different applications that people just were inspired. Mm. If you can imagine, you know, we all know kind of Android or Google Play Store or the Apple Store, OpenAI, they introduced the equivalent with their GPTs. So people can be really creative about adding on that as well. And then more examples came and customers started to see some benefits and companies, and then it took off like wildfire.
Yeah, so maybe accessibility is the real changer there. And I would maybe think it's likening it to when the search engine on the internet started, really. It just opened up a whole new world to us mere mortals who are not coders and the like. But maybe, Mark, we just lift ourselves above all that for a moment and look at AI from a geopolitical perspective and how important it is politically in the world. Because, you know, a lot of the things that support the advancement of AI are going to cause huge political questions, aren't they? Maybe just we'll start with the issue of power, because a lot of the debate around AI and its advancement is about, you know, how much power they need to advance and expand. So maybe talk to us a little bit about why they're so power intensive.
So when you look at the top nations, they understand the importance of this technology, and they're investing heavily in it from an economic and a military power. They see that to drive and to lead some of these models, you have to put an awful lot of energy into them. And you know, I wrote down some figures which I found absolutely incredible just to think about it, but like, to run some of these models, you could have, for example, over 300 kilowatts for like an hour. Mm-hmm. And like your average US household might use 900 kilowatts for the whole month. Like I mentioned at the start of the call, $191 million to train some of these models. So it's kind of like you're putting it, you're going to these search, you're going to a OpenAI or ChatGPT, you're putting in a search or you're asking it to do something, and it's using a Hoover to suck up all the internet data that's there just to give you your answer. So they're incredibly expensive to run. But some of the larger companies know that if they get first mover advantage here, it'll really play out for them. So from a regulatory perspective, or I suppose from a governmental decision, you have to want to be far advanced in this area to stay competitive, because there's so many different factors at play at any one time that you will actually lose credibility in terms of your offering.
And there is big global competition to try and get these big players on side very quickly. But as you say, and I mean, those figures are extraordinary, power will potentially be the ultimate boundary to expansion. So the power-rich countries, if you like Russia, like China, like Saudi Arabia, they may have the upper hand going into this, because that's one basic thing that they can actually provide for certainty to the likes of Sam Altman and the others who come looking for a basket of things. At least they've got secure energy. So do you think that those power-rich countries will have the upper hand?
Well, I do know that like Sam Altman is rumored to want $7 trillion to go to the next stage of where he feels the product can go. Now, there's not many countries or companies that are able to raise that type of funds, but that's his ambitions. So we need to be conscious that whoever has the advantage on power will play a very significant role in the future. But they're also, it's trying to be smarter about how you're actually using these models. So there's a way of quantization, model pruning, and specialized hardware where you can start to become better actually utilizing the power that you have. But also, as much as we're talking about large language models, there is a shift towards looking at small language models. And the difference with small language models is it's more context specific and more focused on particular problems to solve, and then you learn from that rather than having to suck up all the internet data to come up with a solution. You might want to try to find all the financial services data or make it very, very industry, and that's a lot better on the energy side of it as well. But for now, the companies don't seem to be as concerned about that, because they really want to have that first mover advantage.
So maybe they'll apply sectoral specific AI streams, if you like, and that will be less energy intensive. But what about the other things like regulation and dealing with the issues of like microchips and the availability of battery and all of that. If you're looking at those power intensive countries or power rich countries, just say like Saudi Arabia or Russia, perhaps they wouldn't have the same stringent data protections or regulatory environments that you might have, say, in Europe or the US. Is that something that actually might appeal to those tech giants in a way that they can move fast and break things like they have in the past?
Well, I think what we have to fundamentally understand is that people are concerned about AI and there's a lack of trust for an awful lot of people. And if that lack of trust happens, people are going to be less, they're not going to take a chance to actually want to use it. Now, the EU AI Act has come down the track, and by next year, by May, it will be coming to law and be enforced from 2027. And what that means is there's going to be a lot more stricter requirements about how you leverage people's data, the types of products or services that you provide with AI, just making sure that people aren't taking advantage. That could be as basic as when you're dealing with a chatbot, you're told this is an AI chatbot rather than actually thinking as a person at the end of the line. But from a the US, for example, have imposed export controls on high-end chips. So what this means is it limits China's access to critical components. So any edge that different countries are going to have, they're going to look to play that because they want to be seen as leaders in that area. Now, from a Europe perspective, we don't necessarily have some of the biggest firms that are actually headquartered here that are actually driving some of this, and in the US they would. So those governments are going to have more influence in terms of what's going to happen and how that's going to be played out. I think that for the big companies to really take advantage of this technology, they're going to have trust, and they're going to have privacy by design and have a human-centric approach. And that means regulation is going to be there, because otherwise you're going to be selling to a lot smaller markets and you won't be able to take advantage of that. However, there's still a big journey to go, because from a harmonization point of view, you've got different laws and regulations in the US, in Europe, the UK, but we're seeing they're starting to come together and put that to play, but still it's inconsistent, so there's still a good bit of work to do on it.
Yeah, and you can see those blocks emerging with the UK-US deal last week and then the EU trying to bring in the legislation, but like it's such a difficult one to get your arms around because, as you say, the kind of industry and technology just moves ahead with the consumer. Without that regulatory piece in place, it can be quite difficult to put that genie back in the bottle, as we saw with Facebook and Meta and all of those other platforms. I might just turn to another side of this for a moment if I can, because this is going to be a really big year when it comes to elections. And the world's three largest democracies, approximately 41% of the global population participating in national elections this year. What kind of impact do you think AI will have on the manner in which elections are going to be carried out?
Well, it's a very good point, because you've got 90 elections, and as you said, half the population will be affected by it. So the real concern is deep fakes. These are avatar videos that look and sound like the real person, and usually what will happen is that they'll say something slightly north than what they usually will say. So they won't say something that's completely extravagant. It'd be slightly different, where you'd be thinking, you know what, that sounds a little bit strong, but maybe they're having a bad day. And that could influence voters. But also there's a real challenge around AI robo dialers, where people are getting calls on their phones, and it could be a president being imitated saying a certain content or saying they're voting for a different policy. And then it could be fake content where it's just coming up and it's across the different social channels. So it's very, very important that we get this right and we moderate it, and we do more to make sure people get the right access to the information and it's not manipulated, because it's the people who are in the middle who aren't quite sure which way they're going to be vote, that they'll be swayed the most, because if you're in either camp, you're probably not going to be changed. But those people on the middle, that maybe you get them at the right time when they're going into the polling station, they're the people we need to be concerned about.
That's a really very interesting point, Mark, because you said there people who aren't quite sure. And I'm just thinking to myself, what is my interpretation of AI now, and what has that done to me when I'm looking online or looking at news? And actually, all that it has done for me is make me very skeptical of absolutely everything I see. Everything I see now, I question and say, is that real? Is it generated? And I just wonder what you think of that. Like, if we cannot depend on governments and the companies themselves to regulate themselves, how do you arm yourself with enough knowledge to know what is an AI generated image, news story, and isn't? Or is there any guidance you can give us?
Yeah, so I think what you need to think about with AI is the majority of it is it's personalization. So when you have a Netflix account, you're going to be looking at your account. You're going to have content that's relevant to you, same with your partner or your kids. Or if you make it a purchase online, it's going to be relevant based on your previous cookies, what you've made the purchase before. So you, whatever you're watching or reading is based on what you've clicked before or you like or you don't like. So if you're going down a certain camp, you're going to get fed a lot more about that because the websites know you click onto it, so you get a completely different version. So what I would be saying is, like, it's like anything on the internet, you need to do your own fact checking. You need to make sure that you take it with a pinch of salt. You need to make sure that wherever you're getting your news content, it's verified. And then the people that you're seeing, you believe it's a trusted resource, because up until we have specific regulation for watermarks, where you know if it's an avatar or not, it's going to be very, very difficult to guarantee that it's not fake information or it's wrong. And that's a real challenge for people in society, because you can imagine how they'll believe something that's completely false and is not relevant. But again, this is where having governance, regulation, and trying to have a good balance between the innovation but also on the regulation, to make sure that from a human-centric perspective, we're not taken advantage of, and we grow up in a society that's able to be I suppose as fair and as consistent as it possibly can. But that's something that we need to be all mindful for, and a society I want to live in that's like that.
And let's not forget, Mark, there's huge positives attached to the development of AI here and all around the world. You know, you mentioned the amount of investment that companies are making in this. So, I mean, it could potentially help us as well. It's not just a negative thing.
Well, you know, I set up AI Ireland to talk about the applications, the positive applications for business from health. Like this week, I held a conference at RCSI where we're talking about AI and healthcare. The incredible work that AI has been doing to fast track drug discovery, allowing people to talk, allowing people who are paralyzed to walk again, to be able to give doctors, where they spend 50% of their time writing notes and not being with the patient, giving them the time to spend 45% of that time face-to-face with the patient, being able to have personalized medicine. We've got autonomous vehicles that have 3 million miles. They've driven in the US, in San Francisco, Los Angeles, Phoenix, and they're less accidents. Mm. You know, so there's fantastic benefits that are, like everything, we can get drum down on the negatives, but the benefits can give us a world that we can never imagine being possible.
Absolutely. Look, it's important to remember that this iteration of the technology is in its infancy and the possibilities are absolutely endless. Mark, that was fascinating. Thank you so much for taking the time to join with us today. That was Mark Kelly, Chief Commercial Officer at Aldus and founder of AI Ireland. Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mandy.
You're listening to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, Trump's criminal trial has provided some fascinating insights into the world of Donald J. Trump. After the break, we'll be catching up to see what he and President Biden have been getting up to as the campaign kicks into gear. Don't go anywhere. You're welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Take a quick listen to this.
Of course, the 2024 election is in full swing. And yes, age is an issue. I'm a grown man running against a six-year-old.
That was the unmistakable voice of President Biden there, having a go at his rival, Donald Trump. And the US election is firmly underway as November gets closer and closer, whether they like it or not. The campaign is certainly heating up. A split-screen election is underway as Donald Trump sits in a New York courtroom in a criminal case involving hush money. President Joe Biden is trying to make hay while the sun shines by visiting swing states and fundraising. Today, we're going to look at the effect of these trials on both candidates. And I'm delighted to be joined now by Lauren Fedor, who is the Financial Times US political correspondent, and she covers the White House, Congress, and national politics. Lauren, you're very welcome to News Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I'm sure you're very busy trying to keep abreast of everything that's going on at the moment. So I might start, if I can, with the criminal case of Donald Trump. I just want to get your assessment, if I may, of how that is affecting the dynamics of the US presidential campaign at the moment.
Well, the first major effect that it's having is one of just pure logistics for President Trump. He is forced to be in a courtroom 4 out of 5 days a week for 8-9 hours a day. This really limits his ability to be on the road holding rallies, fundraising, which is very important for him as he continues to spend huge amounts of money on legal fees. But it's really limiting his ability to be out there and running a campaign. Whereas President Biden admittedly has a full in tray being the sitting president, but he also has the flexibility and freedom to be, as you say, traveling the country, meeting voters where they are in swing states, and also holding these incredibly lucrative fundraisers to keep building up his campaign coffers. That money helps him not only buy advertisements on TV and radio and online, but it also allows him to build up a ground game and hire campaign operatives across the country to be knocking on doors and getting his message out.
And Trump, in his own inimitable style, can't go anywhere quietly. But is he using still the court cases and the courtroom as another platform to kind of get his message out?
Absolutely. I mean, we see him speaking to television cameras on the way in and out of the courtroom several times a day. He is still managing to hold more traditional campaign events on the days that he's not in court, which is actually Wednesdays and the weekends. But he's also just using the sheer optics, as it were, of the courtroom as part of his message. He sees himself as a victim of some sort of political persecution here. He believes that he is facing, or at least he claims that he is facing these charges, these criminal charges, because his political enemies don't want to see him back in the White House. That's a message that we saw that resonated very clearly with the party's grassroots throughout the primary campaign. It remains to be seen whether or not that kind of message will work in a general election context when he needs to be winning over not just the hardcore right-wing base, but voters in the middle.
And it really does double down on his persecution complex to say that this is all another vendetta campaign against him. But I just wanted to ask you about the judge in that criminal case. He's been very interesting in some of the actions he's taken against Donald Trump. You might just talk us through some of the incidents that have happened and what the judge has tried to do to curtail some of Trump's pronouncements.
Well, you know, Donald Trump is not supposed to be kind of attacking, say, the judge or other individuals associated with this case. He's not even really supposed to be talking about it outside of the courtroom. You would expect that most defendants would be kind of held to that standard. But in fact, Trump just kind of flies in the face of all of that, continues to be spouting his various issues with the judge himself, among others. Now, he has been censured. He's faced fines and threats of further punishment should he keep this up. But, you know, as you say, he doesn't go quietly. So
he doesn't.
We'll have to wait and see.
And just turning to President Trump for a moment, as you say, look, being in office and all of the responsibilities that go with that is a huge burden on him. But he's starting to get out there on the campaign trail. What are the issues that he's facing at the moment? Huge coverage here for those protests at colleges and the like. What has his activity been like in recent weeks when it comes to campaigning?
Well, look, he's visiting these key swing states for the most part, the states that are actually going to decide this election. You know, many states in the electoral college system in the U.S., we know they're going to go Republican or they're going to go Democrat. But there are a handful of states that could really go either way. So he's spending a lot of time and energy in states like that. States like Pennsylvania, for example, or North Carolina, where he is today. He is also, though, you know, contending, as you nodded to, with these protests, for example, on college campuses. He's not visited any of these protests, but he did come out at the White House just earlier and kind of condemned any sort of violence or disruption to studies. And so I think that is an example, though, of one of the big challenges facing him right now. And it connects to the wider challenge, bigger challenge for him, which is just foreign policy. The conflict in the Middle East weighs very heavily on his presidency, as well as on his kind of electoral prospects. And it's just one example of the kind of challenges that he faces in his current job.
Yeah, and of course, he's also using Trump's criminal case to point towards all of the things that are wrong with Donald Trump and why he shouldn't be president again. But when you come to the opinion polls and seeing where both men stand at this present juncture, what are they saying? Is it still neck and neck, or is there anybody eking ahead?
So it's definitely neck and neck. Several polls do show President Trump ahead. This is, we're talking about a national poll here. Perhaps more worryingly for President Biden, when you look at state level polls, again, in these swing states, President Trump is ahead, and in some cases ahead outside of the margin of error, so comfortably ahead. That's obviously a big problem for Biden. Equally, though, Biden's allies will point to the fact that his poll numbers have steadily improved in recent months, really going back to his State of the Union address in March. And they believe that President Biden will continue to ratchet up his numbers as the months go on. I think, as you noted at the outset, you know, November is still a ways away, and there is still time for him to gain ground. And so his campaign, his allies and supporters are hoping to see that upward trend for him continue. Mm.
We did a profile on this program a number of weeks ago about the candidate Kennedy. And who do you think will benefit from that? Because, I don't know, on first glance, you'd think the Democrat supporters would veer towards them. Is he somebody who's more seen as like an independent candidate who could hurt both of them? Or is it something that could affect Biden as we move forward?
I mean, this is the million-dollar question. Mm. I think there was, when he first kind of entered the fray, everyone's knee-jerk reaction, the conventional wisdom, this was bad for Biden. Here's someone with the Kennedy family name, a former Democrat, who would be eating into President Biden's vote share. However, we have seen in recent weeks suggestions that perhaps there are certain kind of former Trump voters who may be persuaded by Kennedy as well. And in turn, we've seen President Trump and his campaign really ratchet up their messaging against Kennedy, which tells you all you need to know. It shows you that they're concerned about the threat that he poses as well. Mm. And I think the important thing to remember is no one expects RF Kennedy Jr. to become the next president of the United States. They expect that he could be a spoiler, and he could be a spoiler with, at the end of the day, not very many votes at all. But if he picks up votes in some of these key states, a couple thousand votes here and there, it could tip the scales one way or the other. I mean, last time around in 2020, President Biden won certain states by as few as 10,000 votes. That's really, really, really narrow margin at the end of the day.
Yeah, and a really critical point for the next election. As you say, so many undecided voters or swing voters. And a lot of times when you're reading about voting and polls in the US now, it's as if like there's a clump of people who don't really like either candidate. So in that bulk of people who are undecided, what's going to sway them? I suppose that's the interesting thing. And one of the things you've got to look at is Donald Trump appeal. And he's seen, I think, as by Republicans as somebody who's strong and who can take on a Biden presidency. But I'm interested in his demeanor in this court case, because I've seen and read a lot and heard a lot about he's appearing a little bit weaker and a little more fragile, I suppose, than we've come to see his image portrayed publicly.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Democrats love to point out President Biden cracked a joke at that correspondence dinner last weekend about the fact that President Trump appears to continue to fall asleep in court. That's not good, a good look for someone who likes to call his opponent Sleepy Joe, right? Mm. So there is a certain kind of weakness or vulnerability, perhaps, that's conveyed there. I think it's really interesting that you bring up this polling about people who don't really like either. In Washington, among the kind of political chattering classes, the phrase now that's attached to those people is the double haters. They hate both of their choices. And, you know, one of the things that the Biden campaign will argue, though, is that they believe that those people will be ultimately swayed by these more personality or demeanor based kind of characteristics. And at the end of the day, they believe that the polling does suggest that those people do believe that Joe Biden is a more trustworthy individual at the end of the day. And perhaps that will be enough to tip him over.
I do recall, though, 2016, that being the same narrative from a lot of Democrats in particular, who said, look, sense will prevail in the end and Hillary will go over. Now, you know, that was a very different type of campaign, and she was a very different type of candidate. I accept that. But there sometimes seems to me to be this kind of willful blindness that it'll all be all right on the night. When it comes to Trump, everybody will wake up and realize what he's like. And I think that when you start to think about what Donald Trump 2.0 could look like, if there is a way to sort of predict that, you don't need to go much further than the things he said himself. And that, for me, I suppose, is the most surprising thing, that he's so open about the very extreme things he would do returning to office. And that's not affecting him in the polls in the way that you might think it would.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is remarkable to many people, right? Equally, it is still early, and many voters, many American voters, are not as plugged in as you are or as I am. They're not thinking about this right now. They're not really paying attention. And so even though Trump is saying the quiet part out loud, he gave an extensive interview to Time magazine this week in which he really laid out a lot of that vision about gutting the deep state and going after his rivals, among other things. You know, the average voter didn't read that interview. They're not aware of that yet. And so the Democrats believe, yes, I take your point that perhaps there are some who just think it'll all be all right on the day. But I think a lot of them are clear-eyed about the fact they have a lot of explaining to do. They have a lot of messaging to do, a lot of reminding people or telling them for the first time what it is that Donald Trump is now saying, and how he might be different than he was in 2020 or 2016.
Look, this won't be a shock to you, I'm sure, but the Irish electorate is very sophisticated. We're very clued into current affairs, and America, I suppose, is just historically for us, because of our ancestry and our contacts there, is always something of huge interest to Irish people, and we watch it very closely. I just get a sense with Donald Trump and the ongoing court cases that there's a bit of a, there's another one, and no one is paying much attention to the detail of that anymore. But you might just, if you can, and I know this is a difficult one. The criminal case that he's facing in Manhattan is one thing. He has to be there for that. But there's four other cases that are kind of out there in the ether. Any kind of assessment you could give us on when they might actually happen, or the Supreme Court ruling on whether they can even go ahead?
Well, so starting with the Supreme Court, they kind of have a hard deadline, if you will, of like the end of June, early July. They wrap up their session every year annually at that time of year. So that would be the kind of hard deadline I would expect them. We'd have to have a ruling from them by that point, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. However, you know, increasingly, everyone expects that all three of these trials that you mentioned beyond the New York case are all just going to be delayed, delayed, delayed. That has always been Trump's tactic here. And at this point, it remains far from certain that any of them would even begin before Election Day. The other thing to remember, as you say, you know, your listeners are very plugged in, so they probably already know this, but two of the three cases are federal cases, which means that a future President Trump would be able to actually pardon himself from any crimes that he was convicted of. So that almost, if he's able to get himself reelected before he even faces trial, he could make those problems go away for himself, believe it or not. And then there is this remaining outstanding case in Atlanta, in Fulton County, Georgia, which is the county where Atlanta is. That case he couldn't pardon himself from. So that remains a headache for the former president. But that one has also been delayed with some of these kind of questions and challenges about the lead prosecutor on that case and the relationship that he had with his boss there. I mean, it sounds like a soap opera.
I know it does. I know, as you're saying it, it sounds like a Netflix series. But these things are aptly happening, and this is, of course, the case involving the tapes where he tried to influence the election. I mean, you literally couldn't make it up, and wouldn't be surprised at anything that might happen there.
Yeah, I mean, we'll have to wait and see. But increasingly, it does look like these other cases are less likely than not to be punted till after November.
Well, Lauren, you're certainly going to be a very busy lady until then, I'm sure. But thank you so much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to take us through all of that today. That was Lauren Fedor, and she is the Financial Times US political correspondent. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
This is News Talk's Taking Stock. After the break, new export rules to the UK, what they mean for business and for your pocket. Stay tuned. You welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, there was lots of talk about borders this week on the immigration front, but did you know this week also saw the second phase of Britain's new post-Brexit border controls for food imports from the European Union come into effect? And that's happening 3 years after Britain left the bloc's single market and a whopping 8 years after it voted to leave the EU. So what kind of disruption are the UK importers looking at, and why have these rules been introduced now? Well, I'm delighted to be joined now by Jack Simpson, who's business reporter for The Guardian. Jack, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thanks, Mandy. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. Like, before we get into these exports, I'm just wondering if you've been watching the other row that's been big in the news here this week. It's the spat, a diplomatic spat over the immigration laws and the border controls there. I'm always minded of a phrase that was attributed to, I think, an Irish civil servant who said, when it comes to the UK, we think about you a whole lot more than you think about us. Is it something that's registered in the news cycle over there?
Yeah, I think definitely you kind of see it across the sort of political divide in terms of newspapers. It's definitely a kind of huge issue that's kind of, I think, Telegraph ran a front page the other day on it. And yeah, it's definitely kind of caught the attention in this country.
Mm. Well, of course, we spent an awful lot of time talking about the border when it came to trade and not a lot of time talking about what it would mean for people and their passage. But let's get back to that trade issue, because the first phase of Britain's new border targeted operating model, which is quite a mouthful, came into force on the 31st of January. And this is the second phase, which started this week on the 30th of April. What changes came in this week, Jack?
Yeah, so it's part of the border target operator model. And as you say, there was the first phase in January, which essentially was to do with paperwork. It was, if you were importing something into the UK, you'd have to get a health certificate. So that's for plants and other products of animal origin. So essentially, you need to get a health check in the European country. But arguably, this second phase, it's a lot more significant, because this is the first time that there will be actual physical checks of these goods coming into the country. So essentially, you'd have to have your paperwork ready. And then some products of animal and plant origin would need to be checked. And they're kind of categorized in different risk categories. So low, medium and high risk. Low, medium risk can kind of go through without much paperwork and without any checks, but it's the medium and high risk products that will be, or are supposed to be, checked. But I'm sure we'll talk about how much checks are actually taking place.
Yeah, and you were writing about this issue this week, and you said that food importers in the UK say that these new Brexit checks could add an additional 60% to cost. Is it that significant for the importers?
Yeah, it definitely is. So I think the import that you were referring to was an importer that brings in goods, particularly meat goods, from Poland and Eastern Europe. And essentially what they were saying was that if they're bringing a big mixed groupage load, which is made up of different products, so different meat products from different locations, they will have to pay for each one of them a kind of rate of £145. So in that case, I think they were saying that for one of their average trucks, which is about 20 tons, they would have to pay an extra 1,500 euros, I think it was, on top of that. And then when you add that to what the transport costs would be anyway, which is about 3,000 euros, kind of comes to sort of between 50 and 60% additional cost.
Yeah, they're very significant. And we'll talk about how that might be passed on to us, the consumer, eventually in a moment. But just on the practicalities of this arrangement, the UK government's saying that it's going to take a pragmatic approach to introducing the checks themselves. But you mentioned that these are possibly more significant because they're physical checks. Where do they physically happen?
Yeah, so the physical checks basically happen at what are called border control posts that have kind of been set up across the UK sort of coastline, really, at kind of significant ports. The most significant border control post will be one at a place called Sevington, which is 20 miles inland from the port of Dover. And obviously, because the short straits. So between Calais and Dover is kind of the busiest port. That will see the most physical checks basically happening. But there are others, you know, in other places up north in places like Hull and Immingham, and down south in places like Portsmouth as well.
Mm. And we look, when we're talking about exports and imports here in Ireland, we always tend to think of ourselves, and obviously such a huge trading partner with us, the UK, but obviously you're importing from other countries as well. How has this gone over the first couple of days? Are you seeing any delays at those ports that you mentioned, the distribution centres there, or how is it going?
Yeah, so I have been speaking to various sort of trade bodies and businesses over the last couple of days. And I think it's important to point out that kind of in the lead up to these physical checks coming in, the government kind of quietly but significantly scaled back the amount of checks that they were going to bring in. So I think initially the kind of check rate was 100%. For high-risk products, which I suppose the most significant is plants for planting, and then on medium-risk goods, which can range from, you know, cut flowers to meat and dairy and egg products, that would be between sort of 1% and 30%. But from what we understand and from what the kind of government's told us, that's significantly scaled back. And, you know, in terms of companies that I've spoken to have gone through, not many have been checked at this stage. So we haven't seen the sort of, you know, horror story nightmare scenario where we see massive build-ups at the ports and that sort of thing. And also, I think it's important to point out that one of the things that the border control post would have done was check people with sort of wrong paperwork or paperwork that didn't quite align. And I think from what we've seen, from what's been reported, some of those lorry loads are just being waved through just to avoid disruption, basically.
So an incremental approach to its implementation, rather than going from 0 to 100, they're kind of, you know, kind of going to incrementally introduce it. But why now, do you think? They've obviously delayed this introduction of this particular system for on a number of occasions. I think it's 5 different times. Why now? Why are they introducing it now?
Yeah, I think basically they have to do it at some point. And, you know, as you kind of alluded to, there's been 5 delays over a period of 3 years, essentially. And it's got to the stage where it just has to happen, basically. And I think, you know, in terms of the January phase that came in terms of the health checks and paperwork and that sort of thing, that's almost been seen as a bit of a trial run for what's coming now. So, you know, I think if that went really, really wrong and there was lots and lots of mistakes, they may have pushed it back a little bit. But I think with these scaled down checks and, you know, various other kind of changes that they've made, I think they've just got to the stage where they need to introduce it, and this is probably the best time.
Yeah, they had to bite the bullet sooner or later.
Exactly,
if you're just tuning in, folks, you're listening to News Talks Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, and I'm speaking with Jack Simpson, who's a business reporter for The Guardian. Jack, you know, like so many of these new regulations, lots of them brought in as a result of Brexit, the larger companies, the big multinationals, they've got the means to grapple with all of this. But what does it mean to the small and medium businesses that you've been speaking to? Because you spoke to a lot of them in your research for this. How are they dealing with the red tape on this?
Yeah, so I think as you kind of allude to, there is definitely a difference in the impact on larger companies and smaller companies. I think one of the key things is with the larger companies, they've usually got massive teams of sort of, you know, back office staff and customs experts and that sort of stuff to deal with the paperwork and the changes. And I think that's one of the things that's really kind of hit home speaking to, you know, your really small SMEs or your delis and that sort of thing. They're having to run their business while they're having to sort of get their heads around, you know, all of these sort of changes as well. But I think kind of specifically in terms of these checks and these costs and that sort of thing, the way that the costs are set up is basically you have to pay £145. There's a cap, £145 per consignment. So, for example, if you are a big retailer that is bringing in, say, one type of beef from one location, that whole lorry would cost just £145 to get through because it's one type of consignment. Whereas with the smaller companies, they're having to basically have consignments on lorries. So as a result, if they've got a few consignments with different products from different places, they're going to be having to pay disproportionately more compared to the larger retailers. And just the costs are just quite significant.
And I was thinking about that, actually, because the logistics of that can actually be quite cumbersome as well. If you think, like, what do they do if you've got multiple products of different categories in one shipment? Do they physically unload everything? Are there checks that can be done in advance? Do they have to lodge papers to say what's in it? And who decides this is where the spots checks are going to happen?
Yeah, well, I think that's definitely one of the big concerns that a lot of these companies sort of have. You know, a lot of them are kind of working on just-in-time supply chains, whether you're kind of, you know, exporting meat that kind of needs to be chilled. You know, there's concerns around, you know, whether they'll be stopped. It's not quite clear yet from what the government's saying. So, you know, if you are held for sort of 5 hours, that impacts on shelf life and that sort of thing. And I think, you know, from the sort of horticultural sector as well, you know, a lot of these people are bringing in sort of young plants that will be brought to the country and then grown, and they're obviously very fragile, need to be kept in sort of ambient temperatures and that sort of thing. So there are definitely concerns around sort of that.
Yeah, a lot of logistical issues as a follow-on from them then. Jack, when you're talking about these type of issues for business is one thing, but if you take the corollary of what you've said there, adding maybe 60% costs to some importers, eventually that has to trickle down to us, the consumers. Any predictions as to how this might affect very important commodities like, you know, meat, milk, eggs, all of the stuff that have been wrapped up in the cost of living crisis and supply chain issues? Would there be a fear that this could have a knock-on effect on consumers quite quickly?
Yeah, definitely. You know, that's the warning that's coming out of a lot of the trade associations. You know, this will eventually have to be borne by the consumer, essentially. You know, if you are a small deli and you're having to pay an extra £200 to get an export health certificate, and then, you know, as I say, the £145 to get stuff over and that sort of thing, you know, you're not just going to swallow that cost. You're going to have to sort of push it on to those buying the products, basically. But there has been some. So the government says that essentially it will add £330 million a year onto businesses in terms of extra costs, and that will equate to around 0.3% on food inflation over the next 3 years. But there have been kind of more stark estimates. So Alliance Trade, which I think does a lot of the insurance for these companies, they put the figures more at £2 billion a year, and it having a sort of impact on headline inflation, which would be more like 0.43%.
Yeah, this could be one of those stories that's a slow burner, if you like, as they increase the level of checks, as they kind of try to ramp that up, if it does start affecting the supply chain and indeed start feeding into consumer prices. It could be one of those ones that kind of slips through the radar, and yet we're all feeling it in our pockets and at the tills. I just ask you, Jack, there before I let you go, do you think the government did enough to kind of explain this for businesses and for the people who have to deal with this every day, those small, medium enterprises you're talking about? Or is there still a lot of uncertainty out there about what this actually is?
I think, you know, if you speak to many, many businesses and trade associations, I think they'll say the government's been quite inadequate in terms of their communication. I think in terms of businesses in Europe, you know, I think particularly around sort of the January time, I'm speaking to a lot of organizations who are essentially saying our suppliers in Europe know nothing about this. And this was causing issues. This has caused issues already in terms of, you know, I spoke to a sort of German sausage specialist in March, who basically had run out of sausages because their suppliers just, you know, didn't know how, wasn't aware of the rules or anything like that. And then I think in the UK specifically, and I think particularly around some of the key bits of information, you know, they only brought out what it would cost to go through sort of Dover and the Eurotunnel 3 weeks before the checks came in. And in terms of the scaling down of the checks, the government, it took a sort of Financial Times story to sort of get the government to actually explain what they were doing and how many things would be checked. So I think there is massive confusion still around what exactly is going on. And I think the government could have done better in that area.
Well, look, Rishi Sunak might think he has some level of political crisis with his local election campaign, but there'll be a real crisis if they stop those sausages coming into the UK. Jack, look, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, and thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. That's Jack Simpson, business reporter for The Guardian. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first from Friday mornings on the News Talk app. My thanks to all of today's guests for their time and very valuable insights. Thanks also to the producer of Taking Stock, John Fardy, Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt were on research, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Any comments on any of today's items, please email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton Savage is coming up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots more. But for now, from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.